proceed with what you're planning. Sorry, that took rather long to expect. I'm going to speed read the next bit because I don't want to wait and speak. Urban growth boundaries, I've had the ground submissions. And a lot of this I actually touched on and talked about Veronica last week, so a bit of shortened names. Paragraphs, section 1, I dealt with last time. Section 2.1, I referred to submissions last week about Veronica and suggest that the Wapiti Basin is a different kettle of fish. And 2.2, the purpose of these submissions is to highlight inconsistencies and to question whether the UGB mechanism is necessary. And I'm going to make it quite clear, commissioners, my clients are agnostic about whether the council uses urban growth boundaries or not, provided that the concept is consistently applied. 2.3, I say that
before you rock on, Mr. Goldman, I took, I read that in your pre-circulated submissions that it should be consistently applied, and I wanted to ask you what extent is that case? Should the policies acknowledge the different characteristics as between Wanaka, Paratown and Queenstown Wall, which seem to present different issues in terms of urban development? So how consistent can it be given those different characteristics?
Well, as I submitted last week, Commissioner, my basic submission was that the overarching policies don't make much sense, and if you're going to have UGBs, there should be a set of UGBs for Wanaka and a set of UGBs for Arrowtown relating to specific circumstances. And that's what I call a consistent approach. Yeah, not the same policies, but the consistent approach should have a set of policies and objectives or policies that relate to that particular UGB. And then that leads on to whether, in fact, in some cases, the UGBs are necessary. I'm not saying the same policies and objectives should apply. I think that's the problem at the moment. And secondly, the consistency is that if you're going to have a UGB, it should contain the urban growth areas. There should be some inside and some outside. That's another aspect of consistency. Paragraph 2.3, I submit that the infrastructure evidence presented to Council not only does not provide any specific justification to the identified UGBs, it's arguably misleading on the subject of infrastructure capacity. And I say that I don't want the word misleading to be taken wrong. There's generic evidence that UGBs can be a good idea. I'm submitting that, in actual fact, there is no evidence before you that in the Wapiti Basin, infrastructure is a relevant consideration for UGBs. I always think a picture can sometimes tell a thousand stories, so if you'll excuse my Annexure 8, which is a combination plan of the basin with my scribbling all over it. But this is part of what was my orange tree analogy last week with a muddy bit of Tim the Great one, wasn't it? But I've just drawn in, and this is not evidence, commissioners, it's public knowledge, and I'm sure your council officers can confirm roughly where the primary sewage networks run, the water supply networks, the pinks, the public transportation runs right through the basin. The numbers are the different urban areas. One's Arthur's Point, two Sunshine Bay, Fern Hill, three's Queenstown, four's Frankton, five's Golden Heights, six and seven are Jacksworth and Henley Downs, eight's Quail Rise, nine's Shot at the Country Lake has estate, 10 sometimes overlooked, there's a residential zone adjoining Lake Hayes, 11 is Arrowtown, and 12 is Millbrook Waterfall Park. I'm just saying the pattern of the basin is very different from Wanaka, which is the point I was making last week.
What do the dotted lines represent?
The dotted lines, 7 is the recently confirmed, that's my orange, new urban development. 7 is the PC 44 that was confirmed by council last week.
The dotted black line.
The dotted black line is, I'm aware that the council is discussing with Henley Downs the extension of the sewage network out to connect Henley Downs.
So that is potentially...
That's a potential sewage connection. And 7, Commissioner, for those who don't know, it's just been upzoned from 1,200 to 2,400 houses, I think.
Around, I think it's 2,200.
2,200, yeah.
And got also the same corner of Hogan's Gully Road and McDonnell Road.
Yes, that top right, the orange bit is the SHA, the SHA, Arrowtown Retirement Village SHA, recently recommended to the Minister for confirmation. So the dotted black line there and the dotted blue line assumes, I understand, that water and sewage will be extended out to service that SHA. And the third orange one is in the middle beside nine is the recent Brightside SHA. My very simple point, Commissioners, is that in this basin, there are no showstoppers of infrastructure anywhere. You could put urban development virtually anywhere because all of the networks are in place. Maybe to upgrade a pipe or a pumping station, but they're there. And in fact, there are some quite strong arguments that urban development makes efficient use of the existing infrastructure. One of the strongest arguments in favour of the expansion of Arrowtown, which was turned down by the Environment Court, was that it made use of existing infrastructure capacity. And that Arrowtown SHA, which is kind of right out on the end of the network, will be connected if it's approved. So infrastructure actually probably supports urban growth rather than is an argument against it.
But that's more or less likely arteries and not seeing all the capillaries that go through the existing urban areas.
Correct.
It's just those capillaries that would have to be provided elsewhere if you had nodes of urban development everywhere else, which I think is infrastructure.
Which the development only pays for.
I don't think that's the claim that's remaining in the question.
Anyway, I'll move on. 2.4, I query whether the overarching policies are necessary or appropriate. There's a bit of a grab bag. I said this last week. 2.5, I commented on this last week about 4.2.2.1, urban growth boundaries defining the limits of urban growth. Now, this is partially a policy issue, partially a mapping issue. But at the moment, in the basin, the policy is not actually reflected in the boundaries, and just as a matter of information, and you can check these plans with Mr. Baxter on Thursday if you wish, Commissioners, in Appendix B, this is the Millbrook Master Plan, 450 units. It's called a resort zone, but it's actually a residential zone with a golf course and some visitor accommodation. Would be urban by any definition of the word. And then, as a matter of interest, and this is very schematic, the second plan in Appendix 1 is Waterfall Park, zoned for 100 units. So I asked Baxter Brown to take the zoned areas out of the district plan and put 100 units on them.
How long has that been zoned?
As long as I can remember.
I think that was in the Council decisions on the operative plan, wasn't
it? Been there,
yeah.
I mean, you can see the first. Sorry, I should have said the first plan for the other commissioners. The first plan, the Millbrook plan, in the middle slightly to the right has a rectangular area, full of bush. That's the Waterfall Park Zone. The Waterfall Park Zone is then reflected on the second plan, and that's what it's zoned for 100 units.
Do you think it's a good idea, considering
the top
priority?
No,
I don't think
that's not the point. That's what the zoning is.
That's the point.
It's zoned for 100 units. And the only point I'm making is that if, for example, this district plan had an urban growth boundary and avoiding urban growth outside the boundary, and I tried to consent either of those two developments, I think I'd struggle against that policy. It would be urban growth. So, urban growth boundaries, if there are going to be urban growth boundaries, they need to reflect the reality on the ground. 2.7.
Excuse me, Mr. Bill, do you want to reflect on that? Because I think that with Waterfall Park, it's not what's on the ground, but it's what's consented in the plan.
It's what's zoned in the plans. I meant what's
zoned. And you're obviously going to come to the definition of urban activities, and I'm not sure whether you were present when I asked Mr. Winchester what the current definition actually means. And because I don't understand it. And that's anticipating, and so since I've interrupted you, you've drawn to our attention the Auckland RPS definition, which I've used this analogy before, to my mind is like the duck. It looks like a duck. It probably is a duck.
Yes. That's what, what I'm going to say to give my tuppence worth on urban development. I first of all said that this panel shouldn't try to achieve the impossible. I've searched. I can't find a case or anywhere that has a, or a district plan that has a definitive definition of urban development, as in absolutely says it. It's something you can tell from the definition of what urban development is. No one else has managed to do it. And I caution you against trying to do it, trying to do what no one else has done. I note briefly in my third attachment there's a submission from Millbrook, which I've copied in Appendix 3, seeking to redefine urban development. The first three kind of make sense, perhaps, but D does not include resort-style developments, which is actually in the Millbrook zone. Would, in my sense, be a completely artificial definition, because the Millbrook zone is urban, people live there, you can buy a section, build a house through permanent residence. And
suffers from the same failing as the existing one, doesn't it?
Yes.
By excluding the rural zone.
Yes.
It says that any development is rural.
What you don't want is an artificial definition, and you can't exclude what is urban. Well, you can, I suppose you can try to, but it makes no sense. And then I suggest to you, I actually look after the comment you made, Commissioner Nugent, about the ARPS decision. I went and looked it up and looked at it and thought it's probably about as good a one of it, as good a one as I've seen. Because I think it is a duck situation. The definition is there. It's a bit fuzzy, but you kind of know it if you see it.
And it also has the benefit of a string of superior court cases interpreting it.
I imagine it does. I haven't read them, sir, but I'm sure it does. So that's why it happens on the definition of urban development, if it assists. Over the page, I commented on the anticipated demand planning period one last week. I then read Mr. Pates's summary, and I kind of got the impression that maybe that particular policy was meant to be global. In other words, all of the urban growth boundaries and all of the district will provide enough growth for the next 10 to 20 years. I thought maybe that's what they're trying to do with that one. But I don't know what they're trying to do with that one. So vague, it's difficult to understand or reply, and it's not supported by factual analysis. The next overarching one with urban growth boundaries, land is allocated into various zones which are reflective of the appropriate land use. Well, self-evident statement. Actually applies inside and outside a zone. It's a method, but understand why it needs a high-level policy. The next one is this one about identifying specific areas. I submitted last week that it's being applied inconsistently with Mount Iron outside and the Fairview Hill inside. But I actually suggest that you could have a policy like that. If Arrowtown has its own urban growth, has an urban growth boundary with policies, you can have a policy about Fairview Hill that says what Fairview Hill is. Eric could have one about Mount Iron. I don't think you need an overarching one. And the final overarching one, I suggest, undermines the entire UGB concept. They may need to be reviewed and amended over time to address changing community needs, then what's the point of having it? I just kind of, especially bearing in mind the Arrowtown Environment Court decision, PC 29 or PC 30, which I referred to over the page somewhere, where the Environment Court addressed the issue of whether Arrowtown was entitled to stabilise its growth or should accommodate demand or should be accommodate part of the basin's demand, and the Environment Court held that if Arrowtown wants to maintain its character and identity, it's entitled to stabilise its growth. So, as I understand, the Arrowtown UGB is actually intended to put a line around Arrowtown so it can't grow. It's full, just about.
The question I was going to ask you last week, when you were referring to the Wanaka UGB, was that one of your points then, I can't picture of thoughts right now, was saying that you felt that it should be made clear how changes to the UGB would be applied. And he say the statement that it may need to be reviewed and amended over time undermines the entire UGB concept. So
what I said last week is that I understood the Wanaka UGB to provide for 30 to 40 years growth. And I said, well, if that's what it's providing for, then there could be a policy that says this UGB is providing for the next 30 to 40 years growth, and it won't be revisited. And Arrowtown could have a set of policies. If I understand Arrowtown, it doesn't want to grow, it wants to be contained. It could have a policy that says so. If you have different policies for each UGB, then these kind of vaguenesses can be dealt with.
Can you tell me, sorry, what number your Wanaka one was in from last week?
What so number?
What number your Wanaka UGB submission was? Fire on this so that I can...
No, I haven't got it on me. It was for Allenby Farms, anyway.
Mr. Goldsman, question of interpretation. I think that when you said stabilised growth, it's something of a euphemism as a result relates to Arrowtown, it's prevent growth.
Sorry, it was stabilised population.
Stabilised population.
The judgment uses the word Arrowtown stabilising its population.
At current levels.
At whatever the boundary will enable. I don't know whether it's current, but there's a bit of growth there. But
and again, as I understood your submission, your characterisation of the Environment Court saying, in effect, that this may be a paraphrase too far, tell me if it is, that Arrowtown could, in effect, export its growth as long as there was somewhere else to accommodate that growth. Have I understood that correctly?
I put it slightly differently. The judgment referred to growth figures and growth capacity in the area, and as I recollect it, said, well, there's plenty of capacity elsewhere. Arrowtown doesn't need to provide for part.
Do you think that it is legitimate, having regard to the reasoning of the Environment Court, to consider growth capacity outside the district? And I'm thinking, obviously, Cromwell, further afield than that. Is that legitimate for this district to take that view?
I would answer that another way, with a bit of a story. Some 20 odd years ago, I went skiing in Zermatt with my wife. Stayed in a nice little hotel. Loved it. Great place. Chatted to the hotelier. And said, well, who do you talk to buy a bit of land around this place? He said, you're about 300 years too late. And when he said that, I thought to myself, that's going to be Queenstown. So my answer... And I know the government is talking about legislation which will require people to keep accommodating growth. And I'm not sure this is a submission or personal view, is that Queenstown should provide for the growth that it can accommodate and accept that one day it will be full. Because that has to happen. It just can't keep growing. It's a very constrained basin. There isn't much land available. Dunorky might develop as a satellite area, and Kingston might develop as a satellite area, and there might be more growth. So I'm not sure whether the answer to your question is, can Queenstown export growth somewhere else? I think the answer is the Queenstown Lakes District should formulate policies for its own future and accept the reality in the world as we know it, that people are continuing to allow them to migrate and travel around the world. They will become full. And they should say so, eventually. And I think Arrowtown, rightly or wrongly, is effectively doing that now.
So
it's now held by the Environment.
So, on that basis, is it your submission that the planning should identify those matters that determine where urban growth can be accommodated and the amount thereby, and then state that that is to be the end of it.
I think when you get your capacity figures, you might find out you don't need to worry about it this plan because there's a lot of capacity there. Probably the next plan might have to face that. I mean, clearly there should be guidance. I wouldn't face that. I'd rather suspect, I'll make this point a bit later on, when you come to the end of this exercise, there have been so many rezoning proposals and so many development proposals that you are going to be dealing with. Urban development can only go in a finite number of places in this basin, in this area. It's highly unlikely to go up the hills into the ONLs because the policies are so strong. You can't get through those ONLs. The council in this plan has rezoned the three or four most obvious flat areas in the basin to rural lifestyle. There's only three or four others. And you have rezoning proposals in front of you for all of them, I think, except the northern side of Mulligan Drive.
So is that a yes?
I think by the time you come to the end of this exercise, you may find, if you put the zones in place and the other rules in place, that you do effectively determine the future of this district.
Well, what I was really asking is whether, knowing that there are some mapping questions and rezoning sort, whether in fact the plan should set out in its objectives and policies how decisions on where and what urban development can occur in the district. In other words, not be responsive, and reactive probably is the best way to term how the operative plan is. Whether this plan could actually set out some criteria in its policies as to where and how.
I think my answer is actually almost going back to my previous answer. I think you need to answer that question when you get to the end of the process and decide whether you think that is necessary. Because I rather suspect it may not be. Up to Queensland UGB, and again, I'll just speak through these. The policies for Queensland UGB limit the spatial growth of Queensland so that the natural environment is protected from encroaching by urban development. Mr. Clinton Bird was very strong on the mountains and the lake being very important and not going up the hills. Most of the Queensland UGB boundaries are zone boundaries and ONL boundaries. Question you might want to put to the staff is, when in the last 17 years has someone tried to extend urban development through into the ONL in the basin, and when has it been successful? They are very, very, very strong boundaries.
Mr. Goldsmith, if you put to one side the ONL boundaries, my instinctive reaction to your Appendix A showing we have 12 separate urban areas that's a lot of evidence of sprawling urban development already. Maybe not in the ONLs, but across the basin.
Well,
or is that a separate issue?
That's a bit of a broad generalisation.
Well, I know.
There's a whole bunch of reasons why different areas have happened. I mean, Arthur's Point is, goes back to the gold mining days, originally. So there are historical reasons, there are topographical reasons, there are other reasons why things have happened in different areas. And I'm not saying that there isn't a threat that, in some areas, that there could be spread, and that may have to be dealt with. The little point I'm making here is that, you know, if you got someone to draw a map of how many of the current urban growth boundaries are ONL and pretty rock solid, you'd probably be surprised at how much of it is that way. And that may in fact highlight to you that there could be two or three areas that are particularly open to spread. I can think of a couple off the top of my head. But do you need urban growth boundaries around all of these things to deal with possibly two or three areas which could spread? Maybe you do, maybe you don't. I'm just saying that most of these boundaries are in fact ONL boundaries which are virtually unchallengeable. The next bullet point is really the same issue. The next bullet point, residential settlements become better connected through the coordinated delivery of infrastructure and community facilities. I suggest there's no evidence or support or explanation as to how the Queensland UGB will achieve that outcome, especially when you look at the pattern of development that I've shown you in the basin. Transport networks integrated and the viability of public and active transport is improved. Yes, intensification will help. There's actually quite a strong argument that additional growth in some areas like Arrowtown would support public transport, because what's needed here is more buses more often, which means more people. Provision of infrastructure occurs in a logical and sequenced manner. There's no evidentiary support to establish that the Queensland UGB will assist to achieve that outcome. And in fact, there's an entirely different suite of policy provisions intended to achieve that outcome. 4.231 to 4.234 is dealt with elsewhere. While the Queenstown Town Centre is a key tourism and employment hub is strengthened, don't know how the UGB does that. The role of Frankton in providing local commercial and industrial services is strengthened. Don't see how a UGB does that. And strangely, the plan contains no reference to or explanation of the separate Arthur's Point UGB or the separate Shadow of the Country Ladies Mine UGB. There's actually three of them. I think it's assumed that the phrase Queenstown UGB applies to those other two separate ones as well. Doesn't say so. And my 310, I've already made that point. I suspect by the time you come to the end of this whole exercise, you may actually find that Queenstown new urban growth issues are largely sorted. Arrowtown, very quickly, unclear whether the planning period policy has any relevance to Arrowtown. Adjoining special zone areas like Millbrook, the treatment is different from the approach to Jack's Point, which is inside an urban growth boundary. And then there's two policies for Arrowtown. Limit the spatial growth of Arrowtown so that adverse effects of development outside the Arrowtown urban growth boundary are avoided. I ask, what does that actually mean? And can be better worded? I think it means Arrowtown wants a green belt. If it's meant to mean that Arrowtown has a green belt, why not say so? And the landscape and identity of the settlement and its setting within the landscape is preserved or enhanced. I submit that's arguably the only policy which correctly identifies the real and probably the only reason that the Arrowtown urban growth boundary. I repeat you for the two environmental court decisions, that was upheld in one of them. Could be achieved by policies. If it's appropriate for Arrowtown, doesn't mean that it's appropriate elsewhere in the basin. I mean, Arrowtown is a special case, and historically is always a special case. Then coming briefly on these two rules, 6412 and 6413, which appear at the end of chapter 6. 6412, which directs, you can read it there. I find that one a very strange rule. My yellow, as usual, by the way, my yellow is my additional since I submitted this. I'll read this one. There's no difficulty with this rule insofar as it applies to the rural general zone, which in the entire landscape chapter and the landscape related objectives and policies of the strategic direction chapter are specifically intended to apply to the rural general zone. The problem arises in all of the other zones. And the ordinary course of events, the extent to which these high-level objectives and policies are relevant for a specific non-rural general zone should be reflected in the objectives and policies within that zone, such as rural lifestyle. Rural residential should have its own policies. There should be no need to refer back to high-level objectives and policies, and there should not be a direction to do so. This issue is particularly significant because of the fact that the DPR proposes that all subdivision in all zones is fully discretionary. That's another debate for later. But if it stays, that will automatically trigger application of this rule, which will create significant uncertainty as to how the district plan is to be applied. If you have a fully discretionary subdivision in an urban zone beside an ONL, how do you apply the objectives and policies that relate to development beside ONLs? It just creates confusion. There is no difficulty with the concept of higher-order objectives and policies applying in the case of a proposal which is not anticipated within the specific zone and will therefore almost certainly be a non-compliant activity, but that will automatically trigger application of the higher-level objectives and policies. There's no need for the direction contained in this rule, and I submit that deleting it will not adversely affect the plan and will simplify administration by removing a potential source of uncertainty. And then Rule 6.1.3, just explain this if I need to. Currently, there are certain areas excluded from the landscape plan. For example, the ski area subzones. They are not part of the ONL. They are almost artificially removed from the ONL. There is a valid reason for that. Ski area subzones are semi-terraformed every summer. You've got people drive bulldozers around and change the tracks. They have people all over them all winter. They have throughout the winter, the ski lifts are lit, and the snow are there. The machines pushing all the snow around. It's like a spaceship's landing up there. So what happens up there is just not ONL, and they're exempted. Now this change, instead of saying the landscape categories don't. It says the assessment matters don't apply. So what it's saying is that the ski area subzone, the ONL objectives and policies will apply, but the assessment matters won't. I just don't even understand how that can possibly work. How can you have ONL objectives and policies applying to ski area subzones when the assessment matters that implement the objectives and policies don't? Just literally do not understand this change. The exclusion of those areas is a valid rationale. There's a reason why they're excluded. And then Mr. Brown addresses that in his evidence. I finish off by commenting, as I said at the start, that I'm presenting legal solutions about rural living on Thursday, and Mr. Baxter presents his evidence on Thursday, and Mr. Jeff Brown relies on Mr. Baxter's evidence to say.
Mr. Goldsmith, question for you. I understand the nature of your argument making on the first of these rules, would it be fair to paraphrase it that if the, as you were saying, and that I appreciate this is not the relief you're sort of sector, but would it equally address it if the extent to which those higher order policies were applicable outside the rural zone were made clearer? That specific ones were fingered.
Depending on how clear they were made, yes. I mean, it's just.
And the follow up is that the one that's been exercising me and the one I want to discuss with Mr. Brown, and I put the legal proposition to you, is to the extent that ONFs are contained within the urban growth boundaries of Arrowtown and Jacksport, and that. May have sufficient setting that Mount Iron be within the Wanaka one. Now partly that's a mapping issue, but there's also an issue of principle, because Mr. Barr told us that the intention was that only rural zone land would be classified as ONL. The legal question I have for you is that the tail wagging the dog, isn't what Man of War tells us, that you identify your ONLs and your ONFs and then go from there with your planning planning permissions?
Yes.
The tail doesn't wag the dog. The planning provisions don't determine where the ONL or ONF should be. And what consequence, and what implications does that have for the ski fields?
Well, I think the answer to the ski fields is that it comes back to character and quality and what they are. And the fact that they, because of all of the activities I describe, do not, and I know they're too small to be in our own landscape, but because of the characteristics that I described, that they don't display the characteristics of an outstanding natural landscape. And maybe there's an element of pragmatism here. If you're going to have a ski field, it's got to be able to do all of those things. And the current district plan has always excluded them, presumably for that reason. And in my submission, that exclusion needs to be carried forward, because I literally don't know how you would end up. And I know this is the tail wagging the dog, possibly, but sometimes you have to reflect reality. I think the ski fields are a special and unusual case. An ONF is an ONF. It needs to be identified as an ONF. Inside or outside, the urban growth boundaries, and they may need to be, my submissions here may need to be tailored to reflect that. Although, having said that, there was another way of addressing it. If there's no ONF inside an urban growth boundary, and if it has objectives and policies specifically directed to protect that ONF, then I'm not sure it would need to be also subject to the high water marks, maybe. I'm thinking that through.
Maybe the higher order policies need to carve out ONFs to the extent that they are with them.
That could well do. I must confess, my thinking behind this was I was in the ONLs, not the ONFs. I haven't turned my mind to the ONFs.
And coming to your point, discuss this further with Mr. Brown. If, as a matter of fact, the ski fields are within the ONL, as a matter of landscape assessment, is the answer that the objectives and policies need to cater for that fact in the way they describe the characteristics that we are trying to protect?
Yes, it would actually be an extreme example of the argument I was running earlier. Yes. I think that would be another way of dealing with it.
Thank you.
I need to go back to the ADP, but I think one of the reasons the ADP not raising ONFs is I'm not sure that the ONFs are a landscape category in the ADP. If ONL, DW, ONL, WB, VAL, and ORL.
There are ONFs, they're the same.
There are ONFs, but I don't think they're a separate category.
Because I note, just looking at the maps, that sometimes where the ONL boundaries have been drawn, they don't line up with the rural zone boundary. They extend, for instance, into residential zones and places. And is it possible that there's a distinction between the ONL using small ONL as determined by a landscape architect and the ONL using capitals as identified in the plan, and that the ones identified in the plan should line up with the zones to which they apply?
I certainly agree with the second statement, because I have noticed a few inconsistencies and I just assumed they were mapping errors.
Mm.
I mean, you can't have an ONL going into a residential zone.
Well, you can. I mean, a landscape architect would think you can.
Why? If it hasn't been developed, the landscape architect will say, well, that's part of the adjoining ONL, but if you're going to draw a zone boundary and say you can put houses there,
That's